Sorry, ready.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Robots of Red Tape. I am your host, Nick Shutt. As always, happy to have my friend here, Clint Alanis, with me. Clint, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great, man. Exciting times.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I really appreciate you taking the time to hop on today. For everybody that doesn't have the fortune of knowing you yet, Clint, do you mind just telling everybody a little bit about yourself, your background, and kind of how you got here?
Yeah, it's been a heck of a ride, man. So originally from South Texas, kind of grew up all over the place in Texas and otherwise. Went to a military school for college just because I didn't know any better. They tricked me into it. I wanted something tough because I was looking for that next thing, you know. And they got me there. Joined the Marine Corps. I went on a Marine Corps ROTC scholarship, so that's what put me through college. Joined the Marine Corps afterwards. And then, man, I've had a heck of a journey. I've been an infantryman, a grunt, as we say. I've been a special operations officer. I've been a diplomat. I've been a liaison to a bunch of different countries. Lived overseas 5 years with my family, 5 out of 20. Just had a really, I mean, it's been a blessed life for sure. But it's been an adventure every step of the way.
Yeah, man, I really appreciate that. And how did you go from a Marine grunt to the co-founder of a AI company?
Yeah, I guess brute strength and ignorance. No, that's the fallback. No, it was an interesting journey, man. I mean, to be fair, like you know, I exited the Marine Corps on a high note. I left as a I was a commanding officer of the unit out in Okinawa, Fifth Anglico, amazing group of guys and girls, just great time. And you know, it was the right move for the family to settle down, and that's what we did. We moved back to Texas and settled in. But you know, the Marine Corps doesn't necessarily prepare you for what's next, and nor is it supposed to. Like I don't feel bad about that. It's just kind of the way business is done. But I left the Marine Corps with, you know, not a real clear idea of what I wanted to do. I had a lot of ideas, you know, not tested, so you know, concepts, I guess. And then I wandered out into the world and started having a bunch of calls and a bunch of meetings. And there were really a lot of nice people at a lot of different places that were willing to sit down with me and try to help me out. And I had some interviews, and you know, you can only go to so many different little hiring fairs, or sit down in an interview at a big box firm, and you know, like get shown like, hey, these are, you know, this could be your cubicle someday. And it's like, oh my God, I can't do this. This is not, I can't get there, right? And I ended up kind of chancing on an opportunity down here in San Antonio, where there's a company that kind of is somewhere in the middle of between private equity and venture capital. And they purchase, you know, they do what all those companies do. They buy companies that are proving themselves, and then they kind of restaff them, and they kick them out into the world to scale rapidly. And then, you know, if they can maximize profit, they will. And I was applying for an operations position with them, and I didn't get it. Obviously, here I am. But I walked into this space, and the interesting thing about these people is they bring everybody into their building here in San Antonio. So that company could be located anywhere in the world, but if they buy it, they ship it here, right? And so I walked into this building in downtown San Antonio, and I mean, almost from the jump, just the energy was just like poured out of these rooms, right? There's like these rooms that are collaborative spaces, I guess they call them, right? Like there's not a bunch of cubicles, there's not a bunch of walls. It's like a lot of whiteboards, a lot of people kind of screaming and yelling at each other and frantically trying to figure stuff out. And you know, I had a couple of really good interviews. I mean, it was a really informative process. Ultimately, like I didn't have enough experience to cross the final hurdle with the owners of the big company. But man, I walked away from there and I was like, that's awesome. Like that reminds me of like my team time as a MARSOC guy. That reminds me of what I got into this all for, is that camaraderie, that like, man, we got to figure some stuff out, right? And so we kind of had kind of on the side, I had some conversations going with some friends that, you know, were putting some stuff together, and there was some opportunities, and then all of a sudden it just kind of fell in our lap. And I mean, I guess that's, I wish I could say it was like awesome skill and amazing, like whatever, but no, it was just luck and like good fortune and friends. And yeah, it was really good. It was a great, I mean, it ended up being a good transition. It was terrifying there for a minute, but good.
Absolutely, man. And so you and your friends started Smack Technologies, correct?
That's right. So
And
three founders.
Yeah, what is it? What do you know? What is your organization's mission, and kind of what do you guys do? What problems are you trying to solve?
It's a great question. So I guess, why, like, I guess I'll answer this first and then I'll kind of get into that. Why for like Clint, what is Clint's reason for being involved in this? And the reality is just fear. I mean, and that's probably not the best motivator most of the time. It's been a motivator for many years for me, but I had the opportunity over all these various deployments and living abroad and the rest of it. You get exposed to things like great power competition. You get exposed to like some of the real strategic and operational level complexity of the world. And when I exited, I thought I could put all that behind me. I desperately wanted to put all that behind me, but let me get away from this defense nonsense. And fear has brought me back. And that fear is that we are ill prepared in some ways to answer the requirements that are out there, either today or in the future. And at a very personal level, like I have two teenage boys, and at a very personal level, I can think of nothing scarier than them getting drug on an island hopping campaign across the Pacific or slugging it out in the trenches of Europe, because we failed to adequately prepare and to put together, as a nation, to put together a solution that would have gotten us around all of that. And so, God willing, we don't even see war. That would be way better. But if we find ourselves in that position, and we're falling back on things we learned in the 40s or 50s, like, man, we've misstepped wildly. And so from my perspective, the company's been brought together to try to bring AI ML, so cutting edge technology, against what is inherently an ancient way of doing business, which is how do you fight a war? And ultimately the way we talk about it is, how do you help commanders make decisions? So we're not making the decisions for them per se, but how do we advise them better? How does the system advise them better on these wildly complex situations that they're trying to deal with? And that's across the board, whether you're down in the muddy end, fighting it out, and or if you're all the way up sitting in, a base somewhere thousands of miles away from the war zone, or even in DC, that complexity doesn't change, or it changes, but it doesn't go away. It doesn't get easier to handle. In fact, it's probably harder. So that's really what we focus on, is how do we help the war fighters today and tomorrow to win, and to win as quickly as possible.
Man, that's amazing. It's an amazing mission. Thank you. Thank you for going and doing something about it. You know, a lot of people pay lip service to things like this, but you've actually served, and then you're continuing to serve by going out and trying to address some of these gaps and make sure that we're not reliant on, 70, 80, 80, 70 to 80 year old methodologies and I'm not going to say technologies all the time, but methodologies for sure. Because I would guess that if, God forbid, if we do end up in another like full conflict, like a la World War I, World War II, not 100% sure who our allies would be, where our enemies would be. What I do know is it would be very, very, very deadly. A lot of people would die, unfortunately. And in addition to that, I think that not only will I think that the victors would obviously be a preeminent force in the world. And if we're ill prepared, we would be ill prepared. That's never good. You never, the older, least, the older methodologies, older tactics, older strategies, against new cutting edge stuff generally turns out pretty poorly for for the folks that are behind. In my experience anyway, from as a military history fan.
Yeah, man. I mean, the guy that rolled out to war with a stick when the other guy had a stone. I mean, it was like, wow, I'm not right. I mean, there's a reason why we have invested so aggressively in technology. We as a nation have invested so aggressively in technology over the years. And I mean, it's the concepts, right? But sometimes we can get led astray, or we can get complacent, and that's not the place we want to be.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think a lot about Like navies is something similar, right? Like, if you go to war, you need a new army, right? Like you can train the folks that you have and train new ones and new methodologies. But like you go to war with the navy that you've built 10 years ago, right? Because it takes that long to build ships. And I would assume like you start looking at technology and technology infrastructure, it may not be that long, but it doesn't happen overnight, and the other side is going to continue to innovate as well. And if they have a head start, like that's just a recipe for disaster.
Well, and honestly, what you're touching on is kind of why we jumped into the AI ML world, because software versus hardware is kind of what you're touching on to a degree, right? And what you see, I think, happening across the defense industrial base right now, in America at least, is that there's a real dichotomy between those that are trying to kind of apply those old school ways of doing business. We're gonna iterate on this over years and years, and we're gonna get to the next best version of the thing. And so you get four or five versions into a platform, and it's like really, really good, but it took you 15, 20 years to get there, right? I think that at the same time, on the other end of it, you have people like us and people like other some of non-traditional companies that are coming into it and saying, no, we got to apply modern techniques, and a lot of those are software techniques, but modern commercial techniques, iterate rapidly, throw things away when they're failing, see success when it's happening, because we don't have time. We don't have time for all that. And I mean, and as a startup, you don't have time to iterate, with the government or with anybody, a customer, other than like, how fast can I turn this thing to get the right solution to the right people at the right time? And so that is laser focused on why we jumped into this space, because it's just, one, it's something we can affect change on, but two is like that old way of doing business, you have to do it in some areas. You have to do it with boats, ships, Navy's going to kill me. You have to do it with planes and big platforms, but you still got to iterate at this speed of innovation, or else you're just never going to get there.
Yeah, no, and I mean, you look at like, I spent a lot of time looking at some of like the open source footage coming out of Ukraine and what's been going on there for the last, I think, 3 years now, 2 or 3 years now, 3 years, I think. But I don't know, it like the trench part of it reminds me of World War One, but then there's all these drones, and I mean, at the moment, well, until space, but like it's still sp talk about space, but air, like air superiority is the ultimate high ground right now. It's how we fight. Like, we don't have like starships and satellites that are weapons, as far as I know. We have, if you're able to, and if you're able to control the airspace, with frankly drones instead of fighter jets, right? Which are way cheaper, right? You can make a lot more, a lot faster. Like that fundamentally changes how you need to engage in warfare, and you need a whole new defense mechanism against them in ways that you don't frankly need with helicopters or jets, right? And so you look at like that as a as an example of how technology is still continuing to change how we fight wars, right?
Yeah, and I would add a nuanced perspective, or an additional nuanced perspective to what you just said, which isn't inaccurate. But if you think about it in terms, I mean, to a large degree, at least the way I would characterize the drone warfare that's happening, that we kind of are watching real time on the news, in Ukraine, is that, I mean, that is largely an information operation, which I'm not one necessarily for always pushing information as a way of warfare. But I will say that, like, if you think about the number of casualties relative to the drones that are employed, there are high casualty counts on all sides, right? And the drones are definitely having an impact. But what's more terrifying, or what is more impactful in some ways, is the information space that, because these things are happening, you start to get in people's heads, right? And so now, am I comfortable moving out of the trench? Am I comfortable running down the road? Am I comfortable getting in the car? Do I have to keep the top of the tank closed, which probably you should anyway, but do I have to keep it closed even though it's really hot in here and I don't want to? Like, all of those things end up being kind of increasingly detrimental impact on anybody. And so I think you're seeing that combined with what you're talking about, which is ultimately this integration of autonomous systems of various sizes that have an out I mean they have an outsized impact, on the battlespace or on the battlefield. I mean, nobody We are way less risk adverse with autonomous systems than we are with manned systems. And when that's the case, you can kind of take more risk, but the reward is sometimes higher. So, I mean, yeah, it's an interesting thing to watch happen in Europe right now. And there's a lot of conversations, at least internally amongst us, is how much of that is reflective of a future high intensity conflict, like you were talking about before, and how much of that is maybe very specific to that, to the time and place that we find ourselves right now, which is probably kind of in between two worlds, between a traditional way of fighting wars and the next, and maybe what the next way looks like, which is a lot of autonomous systems and a different level of violence.
Yeah, no, and I think, and I also think, I appreciate that's fascinating, but I think that when you start transitioning worlds, like you said, right? I mean, the conflict that I always think of is World War I specifically, right? Where you have, like 1914, you have French soldiers going off to war wearing the same uniforms that Napoleon was wearing, literally the same uniforms that Napoleon was wearing, right? And you get these incredible pictures out there of, a French cavalryman with a, like right out of the 1800s, 1700s, that has the, like a French cuirassier with the breastplate and the lance and the red pants and blue jacket and then a gas mask. And it's just like, man, what? But like, when you, but you know, and like, I, you know, like World War One, I find it fascinating because first, most people have no idea the outsized impact it's had on today's society in a way. But second, it is that transition period, right? I feel like we as a world went into that with very much of 19th century idealism and came out 20th century through and through, right? And I think, when there is another conflict, hopefully there's not, but when there is another conflict, I think there'll be something similar where we'll come into it with 20th century and walk out with 21st century ideals and power systems and power structures.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I mean it's a philosophical kind of way of viewing it that's an acknowledgement of just how rapidly some things have changed. I mean, if you think about the change, the pace of change between, to your point, the Napoleonic era and some of the things that were happening then up until World War One, and even between World War One and World War Two, I mean, massive difference in applied lethality between those two conflicts. And then you spin it forward to the nuclear revolution, and you just kind of move it. I mean, we are iterating faster and faster, and on par or on scale across the culture. I mean, that can be a very good thing. It can also be a very dangerous thing because we are iterating at that same pace in warfare. And most people don't live with that knowledge or that kind of understanding on a day-to-day basis. And so it's easy to kind of be, happy with the way we're innovating in the commercial industry and technology and how it makes my life easier. But everyone should, I mean, it just should be an understood, those same technologies are going to support the next war. And that's going to make it a different, certainly a different experience. And cognitively, like, and you and I've talked about cognitive stuff, cognitively, like, way more complex.
What do you mean by that?
So, if I think about, I mean, even just my own experience, like, well, let's go back to your example for World War One, right? Like that person riding that, like that guy on a horse with a lance, like God bless him. But like his point of view of the world was like super narrow in scope and very applied against, this is the thing I need to get done, right? Well, fast forward, and I'll just to my own experiences as as a special operations guy. My experiences were I had two radios at all times, right? One in each ear. I had a different radio frequency in each ear because I was managing two different things happening. So different groups of people talking on each ear while dealing with casualties, while dealing with contact with the enemy, while dealing with kind of, how can I support my people? How can they support the people we're supporting? Like all of these different variables, right? In the at nighttime, on nods, all those things. You project that forward to the next conflict, like that's going to look simple, right? Like we talk about it like a colloquialism of like helmet fire. Like a helmet fire is that. It's like, oh my God, I can't get my head around all of the things that are getting like pushed at me, right? Like the things I see, but the things I hear, the things I sense, the things people, I mean, all of this is like it all funnels into a very narrow space, which is my head. And I'm trying to like understand it, right? And so that's a helmet fire. But then if you project that forward, like, I mean, it's that helmet fire is going to seem simple to the people in the future, right? And that we talk about how do we do cognitive offset. You know, that's, I don't know that we necessarily coined that. Probably not. Somebody smarter than me has probably come up with it. But we talk about how our system can serve as a cognitive offset for that person that is inundated with so much information, plus all the human factors like sleep deprivation, caloric deprivation, probably making bad decisions and drinking a lot of caffeine, and using a lot of tobacco and all these other things that are going on. And oh, by the way, the stress of maybe losing some friends, you know, ships being sunk, planes being shot down, all of that, like that is a cognitive burden that if we're trying to move at the speed of what at least we think the next war looks like we can't, the human being can't handle that at the scale required. And so that's, we think that the system augments that and that you basically get to offset or offload some of your cognitive burden onto the system to help you through that.
Oh, that's fantastic, man. How do you how do you go about building that? Like, are you essentially using the system to filter through a lot of the information and bring the only the most important things up for folks, or is it something else?
I mean, there's a lot of variables in it, to be fair. I think that we surface options is kind of how we look at it. There are some people, let me back up for a second. There are some people that when they build systems like ours, they're very, very much focused on like the right now, right? Like, how can I inform a decision as best as possible, like right in the next like 5 minutes, right? And like, that's a time horizon, or maybe the next 5 hours, that's a time horizon. We attempt to project forward into the future and say, like, this is that stuff is extremely important. But if you don't have the larger context of how this all gets orchestrated over the next day, 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, whatever it may be, like you may lose the bubble, right? And so you have to, we surface optionality as like, hey, in the military, we would call them courses of action, COAs. Right. And so if I'm a decision maker, you're going to give me COAs, and those COAs may be the most efficient COA, the most effective COA, the least risk to force. Like, I mean, the user can kind of pick what kind of courses of action they want. The system will surface those. And then because we've applied kind of a predictive analytics over time, as we're actually in execution, the system will evaluate whether we are on plan or off plan. Right, we projected over the next 2 days or 24 hours or whatever that this is where we should be. When in fact we're not there, the system looks at it and it goes, okay, are we on plan or off plan? If we're off plan, why are we off plan? You know, maybe we had wild success and like, okay, well now we have all these new opportunities, we need to take advantage of those. Or maybe the wheels have come off, right? And we're like, we're close to catastrophic failure, in which case it's going to identify like, hey, these are alternative ways that you can address the fact that you're like, you have more risk now than what you thought you had. And so that's kind of like, so when you say like, how do you surface important information? That's the important information that we surface is on the front end, looking forward, what would you like to do? And this is what we predict will happen. And then in execution, you know, hey, you're good boss, keep driving forward, or not good, better figure out a way to deviate.
No, that's fascinating, man. And so you guys are and how do you integrate some of these systems with what we currently have? Because you look at the military now, right? And all the different branches, but also you look at the intel community, because they support a lot of this. I think like none of those systems really talk to each other. Right, like the army system is internal to the army. It doesn't really talk to the navy, which doesn't talk to the air force, which doesn't talk to any of the intel agencies. And from what I understand, if you're say you're an intel analyst and you're sitting in a facility somewhere and you're in a SCIF somewhere, some windowless room, and you need to verify information, you have a different computer for each system. How do you deploy something like this when it's that complex?
I think I would say two things about that. I think one is that I you'd be I think that To their credit, I think the Department of Defense has realized exactly what you're stressing right now, which is like, hey, this, we can't fight like this. We can't fight siloed, right? Where every group of people that specialize in something live in their own little silo, and then it's expected to all go up to the top, and somebody's going to be conflicted up there, but we don't know who. Today, the way that that happens, just as a quick aside, the way that that happens today is we would call it like the battle rhythm, which is basically all of the meetings that take place to bring these siloed people together so that they can talk to each other verbally, make eye contact, figure it out, and then go on, like, so they can get information and go back to what they're doing. As you would imagine, that's a very analog process, very time consuming, people intensive process. So that's the DoD has realized, like, we can't do this. This is not feasible. So they are increasingly adopting a system of systems approach. We want industry, they want industry to bring systems that can then be integrated kind of on scale across these other systems. So that's one way we take a look at it. The other way, again, maybe, if I, or maybe somewhat rosy eyed on my part, but I think that you would be surprised at how much industry wants to work with each other to solve the problems because it is hard problems, or they are hard problems, right? So there's very few industry leaders anymore, at least the ones that we interact with, who are like, I want to, we would say own the stack. I want to own the stack by myself. It's like, no. Most people today have acknowledged, like, that's not a realistic approach to this next war. I'm gonna focus on trying to solve these problems. I'm gonna integrate with other people. And increasingly, I think there are companies kind of like us that look at it and say, hey, the bottom dollar is critical. Bottom dollar is important, but it's not all important, right? We have to get the solution in place. And where there are judgment calls internal to the company on, solution versus internal efficiency or internal, like, saving money or whatever, we're gonna err on the side of solution. And that's kind of the decisions that we've made, because ultimately, like, that's what we're doing for the nation. We're trying to solve wicked problems. So I say all that to say, people have been very, very collaborative on trying to solve these things. Everyone's worried about the bottom dollar, but we collaborate nonetheless. In practice, what we have found is that if the user wants it bad enough, they will figure out how to integrate. And I mean, that's a little bit flippant, probably, because there's a lot of technical hurdles associated with that. But we can get there, especially if the user is motivated to, like, hey, I want that. I need it to survive or whatever. So that's where we've had successes, when it's generated by the user like that.
Yeah, because I mean, I think about getting people in a room and having folks and like hash things out. First, that's going to take way too long. Second, I would assume that the people in the rooms are going to be pretty high up from pretty high up the chain of command. And from what I understand, the further you go up the chain of command, generally the larger the ego becomes, and that becomes a barrier to actually getting things done. Or it can, right? It can if that you don't put the mission first, it has to be my way. And I start looking at things like that. And then I think about like interoperability from a systems perspective, and how, a lot of the things that you talk about, like from intelligence failures, the intelligence failures that led up to 9/11, a lot of that was because they weren't talking to each other, and there was no Or there was they there were there they were very worried about their own domains and not worried about, a unified solution. And if that is that, that leads to that kind of intelligence failure when, frankly, we weren't at war, right? What happens when we are, and then all and now, like, 3,000 lives is can, you know, in a in a in a And this is going to sound callous, but in a full-scale conflict between great powers, 3,000 casualties is like a drop in the bucket. That's nothing. Or it can be.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, frighteningly enough, I mean, I think that it would certainly be on the lower end of anything, that I mean, than an individual engagement, more than likely, in the future world. I was at least blessed with some really good leadership across the board. I didn't experience too much of the ego driving things. I will say that generally speaking, I think a lot of senior leaders especially have a they're constrained in their perspective, because they haven't either needed to or wanted to be exposed to, like, things that they just don't know about. I mean, it's not, in a lot of places, it's not risk aversion or it's not ego, at least again, in my personal experience. I'm not, there's certainly ego.
Yeah, of course.
My own notwithstanding. But what you see is that people just don't know what's even in the realm of the possible. They don't even know what's happening on the other side of the fence. And so we, a lot of times when we come into the conversations, like when I'm doing business development and talking with customers, there are some customers that you go into and they get it right off the bat. They're like, I want this. I want reinforcement learning. I want this, and this, and I want it to look like this. And we're going to integrate here. And it's awesome. I mean, it's just such a smooth dialogue. And then there's other people that you go into the room and they're like, I want ChatGPT. And you just know right off the bat, you're like, all right, we're gonna have to back up a minute. Like, if you've thought or if you are under the impression that the technology that underpins ChatGPT is going to lead to fighting a war, then like we got to go back and like we got to reestablish a baseline of understanding. And that's not because those people are bad people. It's just because they don't know, right? I mean, it's like I asked ChatGPT to do stuff for me. It does stuff for me. I assume that it can do that on scale. It can't. Like, I mean, so. It's an interesting way for us to navigate the space. We do have to navigate the space. There is some level of education that happens both ways. Frankly, I get educated quite a bit from customers as well because there are some wickedly smart people in the military. And I'm never the smartest guy in the room.
That's
So
how you
it's
know
like,
you're in the right rooms. That's how you know you're in the right rooms, right? I don't want to be the
it's
smartest
it.
person anywhere, but go on, man. I apologize.
No, dude, you're 100% right. It's a good. Yeah, there are always good back and forths. Some people are more receptive to like clarification than others. But at the end of the day, like, I mean, we're not gonna can't push something on somebody if they don't want it. And so you have to kind of educate and say, hey, maybe you do want this. Maybe how do you think that works? That's not actually how it works. Let's talk about other ways to do this, you know?
Yeah, I mean, so I mean, specific. I mean, I think we've touched on a little bit of this, but I know obviously you've served in Japan and Norway and other regions as well. What do you know in your experience, what do you think some of the gaps are right now in the in US military strategy?
So I think that in some ways we've lost the focus on lethality. I think that's probably not it's not a the military at the end of the day is intended to be a lethal force. You can use it for other things, but lethality underpins everything about it. Like the day that we lose the understanding that the reason why we have a military is to do lethal things to our nation's adversaries, we've lost the narrative. You know, I think that on top of that, I think that we there has to be this an embrace of the fact that we have to do more with less. The defense industrial base, for a number of reasons, is not necessarily prepared for the burden that would get put on it in the high intensity conflict. And so we as a nation, we as a military, or they as a military, we supporting them, have to understand how can we optimize everything that we do because we have to be more efficient. Like there is no option. There's not, no one's going to come and save us when it goes bad. Like we are the people that go save other people. And so we have to figure out how to be more efficient. And a lot of times our strategy doesn't necessarily lend itself to that. Or maybe it does, in the books, but in application, it doesn't. In application, it's like, well, if one kills it, I'm going to shoot two just in case, right? Redundancy is always better. And so I think that we have to be prepared to accept higher levels of risk of not having redundancy because we're being more efficient. And then probably the last thing that I would say on it is we holistically need to get more comfortable with decentralizing decision making. Like we got in a bad habit, I would say bad habit, 20 some odd years of counterterrorism and a lot of generals getting used to watching Kill TV. Which is the ISR feed of like watching operations happen live. And you almost get to the point of people thinking they can be way removed from the situation, but watch it on TV and understand it enough that they can call down to the people at the pointy end and be like, you should go left and not right. Like that is not, one, it's not helpful. Two, it's not informed And three, it is certainly not how we're going to fight the next war. Like it's just it's an impossibility. So that next conflict is going to look a lot more like I gave them some orders, haven't heard from them in 3 or 4 days, probably good enough. Like let it ride. And that's, that comfort level doesn't necessarily exist everywhere.
How do you build that comfort level?
So that's kind of like part of what we are building. I know you didn't throw me a softball on purpose, but I'm going to take it as a
No,
softball.
dude, go
But
for it. Go for it.
that's kind of what we think we're building, right? Is like if you can make the people at the tactical edge more informed about the context, the campaign context, then you can trust them to make the right decisions when they need to in that context, right? I can't tell you how many times, I mean, I'll put it this way. The difference between what I understood as a lieutenant or as a captain in the Marine Corps, like as an infantry side, versus what I understood about the context of my environment as a special operations officer was night and day. And that's not even derogatory. Like it was purposeful on the infantry side that you only need to know what you need to know and 2 levels up. And 2 levels up for a young lieutenant is like battalion. It's like it's not that high. It's like really limited. Maybe I get to understand what's happening like one ridge line over or like one block over. I don't get the full picture. And I don't need it a lot of times. But when you go in and as a special operations officer and they're putting you in these politically sensitive environments or they're putting you in these really complex, challenging spaces that are like kind of no fail, you have to have a higher level of context. You got to understand, well, why am I doing this? Like, what is the context, not only for like me and like the actions I'm taking, but for the people that I'm fighting against? What are the, why is that? Why do they think that way? What is the, we would call it sources of instability. What is the source of instability that is making them act the way that they're acting that makes them an adversary of mine? And that doesn't really matter whether you're doing counterinsurgency operations or you're doing high intensity conflict. You always want to understand what the adversary is thinking. But again, so that the system that we are designing, we think ultimately provides that campaign context, that understanding of what's relevant, what's not relevant. Why is it relevant? Why is it not relevant? If I only have 3 missiles that are effective or 3 munitions that are effective, whatever they may be, do I shoot them at that? Just because I can doesn't mean I should. And I have to be operating off of something that is more informed than like the brief that I got 10 days ago. And I haven't talked to anybody on the radio since then. You know what I mean? Like there's commander's intent is the backstop of how everybody would say doctrinally we do this, but commander's intent can be consumed by events, but it can also be consumed by exhaustion and all the other cognitive load things we were talking about. So the system helps that, right? At least that's what we're designing.
Awesome, man. That's really, really cool. How do you think, obviously with a focus on, on making the US military more lethal, right? How do you think, where do you think those decision points should be? Should it be like, should there be a human in the loop at all times? Yeah, I mean, if so, like what level does that where what at what com level in command should those decisions be made? Because to your point, somebody on the ground is going to have more of a better they'll have a better understanding of what's going on where they are, maybe not the whole battle space at at large, or if it's a World War II type environment where we are fighting on two fronts at the same time, folks in Europe didn't know or need to know what was going on in the Pacific and vice versa, right? So, how do you, I mean, where do you make those decisions?
I mean, no, there's so many, there's a couple of different ways to go with that. I think that I think that I am terrified of AI unleashed, like holistically, right? And so when you ask about human in the loop versus the other two ways to think, to talk about it is either human in the loop, human on the loop, which you can think of like a series of audits. Where you're auditing as the loop is spinning, and you can stop the loop at any time when you see something that doesn't look right. Like, right, human in the loop is everything goes to a human. The human decides, and it kind of iterates. And then there's human off the loop, and human off the loop is the, I don't computer save me type situation, right? I'm terrified of the human off the human like out of the loop altogether. I think that that is a scary place to live. I think the fact that it scares me doesn't mean that it's not something we have to at least acknowledge as a possibility and understand kind of what are the implications of that. Not because it's what we would want to do, but we have to consider that our adversaries may not have the same cultural norms or moral foundation or whatever it is, the rule of law, whatever, that keeps us where we are in a position of always wanting to kind of stay on that path. If our adversary doesn't, the scariest thing about AI is that it potentially can tip the balance one way or the other between two adversaries, because the decision speed, theoretically, the decision speed of the one that gets out of the way of the computer is significantly faster than the one that's going to stay in the like that's going to try to stay in the loop, right? Even on the loop, even auditing on the loop potentially is too slow. Now there's a lot of other variables that go into that, so that's a kind of broad statement. But we have to just at least acknowledge, like, hey, this is a real thing that we need to consider. And so when I think about it, at least I think about it as like a dial. How loud do I want my stereo? Do I want it at one and I'm just kind of relaxing, it's background music while I'm cooking or whatever, or my wife's cooking and I'm helping or whatever's happening. Is it at a five where I'm like, I'm having a good time, we're all having a good time together, it's moving along, but it's not like out of control? Or is it like at a 10 where it's like the neighbors are going to call the cops, like the wheels are coming off, like, but we're going to burn this thing to the ground? I think about it like that. Now, I don't know that everybody would approach it the same way. I would say that the department has some really deliberate concepts, principles, I guess, on how they want to control it. And I wrote these down just because so I don't forget them. But at the end of the day, like, they have the DoD ethical AI principles for responsible, equitable, traceable, reliable, and governable. Like, that is what the DoD has said, that when we do AI, like, this is what it needs to look like. I would boil all that down to say, do we trust it? Do we trust the AI, or do we not trust the AI? And trusting the AI, I think, is a hard place to get, but you have to play with it, or else you're never going to trust it, right? I mean, if you don't practice with it, if you don't see what mistakes are made, if you don't understand how the system's functioning, the worst time that we would ever figure out what that looks like is like in combat. That would be awful. So it's kind of a roundabout way, but that's at least how I think about it. It is a scary space to live. We have to acknowledge the adversary may get there faster than we are. And I think ultimately the AI that we shape, that is like kind of whether purposely or not, that is based on our moral code, the rule of law, our ethics, whatever, is going to be, it should be a better system than somebody else's.
I'm with you, and I think it's in the loop versus on the loop and out of the loop. Fascinating. I like the idea of the dial turning it up and down. So if essentially, you could have a system that has, human in the loop every time built into it, but then you can automate it more and more based on the situation, which gives you, I mean, also gives you the tactical flexibility needed in things like this, right? And like, I mean, completely out of the loop, I can think of situations where, say, you're falling back and you want to cover, you want to cover forces it's pulling back, having gun fully autonomous guns and pointing them at the, making sure they're pointing in the right direction, obviously, can save you from having to leave people behind to do that, right? So there's absolutely I mean, that's, and I'm sure that there's innumerable other ways, but that's an example that just came to mind, that absolutely, as I can see that being a thing that you would want. But then it's, I mean, shit, can the AI get access to that in the loop versus on the loop control and lock the user out? Like, I don't know, is that, how do you build something like that so it doesn't do that, right? Or it's, because then you start playing with what if scenarios, right?
Yeah, man. I mean, I know that there are some technologists today that like kind of ideate about the day that we get AGI, right? Like an actual superhuman system that functions. Like, there are people that are excited about that day. Like, we're gonna get there, and it's gonna be roses and sunshine. I tend to have a darker view on it, and think that that's probably not something that we should aim at. I think the day that we let the computers take over is probably a really bad day for us holistically. But I mean, I guess people can take a different approach to it. I do know that there are places like in real time where we always try, we being like kind of the my understanding of what the department does is they try to filter all this stuff through the rule of law of land warfare or law of land warfare, ROEs, like all the normal things that we always try to do, or that we have done in the past when humans are involved. And so there is no desire to do away with any of that in the department today, which is, good thing.
No, absolutely it is. What do you think some of the fear, what do you, are you afraid of AI, AI tools like the one you're building or others falling into the wrong hands and being used irresponsibly?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think that, we shouldn't make it too much of a myth. I mean, at the end of the day, it's a tool, right? It's a tool like anything else. And I think the more that you play with it, the more that you realize it's a tool and not, we didn't create God. And the fact that it's a tool means that people are going to use it for different purposes, and the purposes that they're going to use it for are going to be both good and bad. And that's just the nature of humans and the nature of how we impact things around us, I think. So yeah, I 100% think, I mean, people are already doing bad things with it today, right? I mean, what, depending on how bad you want to like look at, there's people are doing bad things with it today. I am worried about bad people ultimately controlling this in whatever context you want to apply it. I think that the way I kind of try to think about it from our standpoint, from warfare fighting standpoint, is that, even if you go back to like ancient Greece, ancient Rome, like the way that the Western world approached warfare back then was an acknowledgement that it was a requirement, but it was a desire to have a just war, right? It was a desire to have temperance and balance and self-control in how warfare was fought. Even if they didn't always live up to that, like that was the ideology underneath, like underpinning all of it. On the other end of it, what they would oftentimes kind of point to as like the wrong way to do business was hubris, right? Like hubris, like pride right before the fall, hubris right before nemesis, nemesis being kind of the construct of divine retribution. And so I think we want to live in that same space. Like anything that we do, we want it to be a just war. We want it to be a purposeful, like we did it on purpose. We did it for a good reason. We want to be balanced and self-controlled in how we do it. We want to be, temperance needs to be involved. And the minute that we get prideful about it, it's the minute where it's going to come crashing down.
No, I agree. A couple minutes ago, you said that you think that the defense industrial base in this country, if we're in another high intensity conflict, that they're not ready. What do you mean by that? Do they just not have the production capabilities, or?
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly, we, I mean, as is well discussed and understood, like we offshored a lot of our manufacturing capacity out of America. There was a lot of reasons for that. I wouldn't necessarily relitigate any of that other than to say that because we did that, and because at the same time we're creating increasingly technologically advanced systems and munitions, you can't mass produce those things, right? I mean, and if you can, you have to have an entirely different type of manufacturing capability and capacity than we have today. And so if we think that we're going to roll out these exquisite munitions or these exquisite platforms or build, aircraft carriers and destroyers and frigates at the rate that we did during World War II, like we're fooling ourselves. Like people can't think that that's a reality. And so, for a long time, I think back, I think it probably started in the Gulf War, the first Gulf War, right? 91, Desert Storm. I think the conversation at that point was we're going to adopt, we as a nation are going to adopt this concept of short protracted conflicts. We're going to win so fast and so overwhelmingly because of our technological advantage and the violence of action that we don't need this massive stockpile that to offset our expenditure, right? I think we then got into 20 years of counterterrorism and counterterrorism slash counterinsurgency, and we were completely unconstrained by resources. We were happy to over resource everything that we did, whether that was, you know, flights or munitions or people or whatever. We put more against it because we could. You know, I don't think that today the defense industrial base, if we said, hey, we just ran out of X, planes, ships, bullets, whatever, we do not have the manufacturing capacity to like suddenly print them all out again.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that that's a secret. I think that's a pretty well understood fact. I think that the way that we approach that at SMAC is to say, okay, well, because that's true, we have to figure out how to optimize every resource that we allocate, that mm-hmm. we, the nation allocates. And so, you know, to go back to what we were talking about before, like that underlying math that leads to a distinction between applying this much or that much or doing it or not doing it at all is not the thing that's ultimately going to make the decision. The commander is going to make the decision at whatever level, but they want that. You want that detail and that data coming to them, right? So they can look at it and go, okay, if I do this thing that I wanted to do, my force is going to culminate in 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
Is that acceptable? And maybe it is, right? Depending on the objectives, depending on the reality of the situation, like whatever, maybe it is. If it's not,
mm-hmm.
give me another COA that like lets me sustain my ability to fight, that I don't culminate. And I think that right now, on the warfighter side, that's too often a guess.
Mm-hmm.
I think on the defense industrial side, there has not been enough. This is like a weird place to talk about. I kind of want to say that there hasn't been enough investment into it to make it to offset kind of the warfare that we think we're going to fight in the future. I think that that's true, but it can be true, and it can also be true that we haven't necessarily optimized the way that we manufacture as a defense industrial base or as a nation because we offshored so much of our capacity.
Mm-hmm.
All of that said, I think it speaks to, and to go back to, you asked about strategy before, I think the one thing that I should have said that I didn't say at the time, our strategy has to be coalition based. It has to be partners and allies that mm-hmm. are involved in it, because anywhere, unless we go to war in North America, which God forbid, we're not, but
yeah,
unless we went to war,
other things have failed then if we are going to war in North America.
Right. And we're fighting on somebody else's backyard. Like we're fighting mm-hmm. in somebody else's, you know, battle space. And so
mm-hmm.
like, there's whole like Clausewitzian thought process between like lines of communication and all that stuff. We don't have to get into that. But at the end of the day, if we're fighting in somebody else's backyard, we're shipping forward. We're never going to have like mass. We're never going to meet what they could put in their backyard because they're local. They're there.
Mm-hmm.
And so if that's the case, we need partners and allies that can also expend their platforms and their bullets and their gas and their people to like on a common cause, or else we're gonna run out of schlitz and it's gonna be real embarrassing.
Yeah. Yeah, man. No, and I completely agree with you. I think that I also think that, you know, the realities of, you know, I mean, our major geopolitical adversary, as you were right now, is, I mean, it's China. I think they're still the most populous country in the world, right? And just period, bottom line, right? They have more people than we do. The only way you win in a situation like that, where you know they have, I want to say, 2/3 more people. I want to say 1.2, 1.3 billion versus us at the 400-ish million range, 430-ish, I think, is the numbers I most recently saw. We have to be at least twice as productive with every person, period, right? But then, you know, you start thinking about the idea of the home front, right? If we're fighting a conflict elsewhere, anywhere, how unified are we as a people? But also how are we going to come together for the common cause in a way, to produce stuff, right? I think that, like, also, you know, there hasn't been, like, we as a country have been involved in multiple conflicts since 1945, right? Now, there's Korea, Vietnam, you know, the Gulf War, the first, you know, Afghanistan, Iraq. I'm missing some, right? But there, we have not we as a population have never sacrificed for that since World War II. Like, we didn't have to, go give, go give pots and pans so that we can melt it down for metals to feed the, industrial base. That's just not a thing. And I think that I also don't know if, I mean, and like, we don't have to get into it. I don't know if we have, as a population, have an appetite for that anymore. Or,
Yeah, I think, I mean, you're touching on, the will of the people. And I think that it's, I mean, that is the danger of a democracy fighting a non-democracy. And I mean, I think that's the reality. It is not only the will of the people, but it's the information flow to the people. If we are an open society and our adversaries more often than not will not be, then their ability to obfuscate from their population what is really happening, and those casualty figures is significantly greater than ours. And I think that to think otherwise is foolish. I think that as a country, I think that what probably too many people don't necessarily embrace, and I won't go too philosophical on it, but I think that what people don't necessarily embrace as frequently as they should is an understanding that in order to enjoy the fact that we are the richest, most blessed country ever in like the history of the world, which we are by far, there will come a time when sacrifice is required, regardless of whether we want it or not. That time will come, and the days of us putting that sacrifice like selectively internal to our culture, putting it on a certain group of people and not accepting it on the broad masses is only going to lead to increased division. There is not a world in which we live in which some people can suffer and some people don't have to suffer, and we're all good. Like that does not happen. So I think that suffering is a good thing, and I think that too many people don't acknowledge it. Like you should force yourself to suffer because that's how your body gets better. That's how you get better spiritually, emotionally, physically, all of it. And if you don't do that, then you're going to be a little bit weaker. And at the end of the day, like you want to be hard to kill. We all want to be hard to kill, regardless of what it is. If it's heart disease or whatever, we want to be hard to kill. And you have to suffer to be harder to kill. And people just, I mean, we are not a, we don't seem necessarily always to be a society that embraces that truth, I think.
I completely agree with you. I also think, without getting, again, without getting too philosophical, I think that we haven't had to pay a price for freedom in a really long time. Period. Like, I mean, outside of the, I want to say, under 2% of the country's population is in the military. And so call it under 5%. I think at peak in World War II, 16 or 17% of the population was enlisted, right? Was involved in the military. And that's not even counting the people that were working in factories, right? The women who stepped up when men were overseas to take care to make the bombs, right? Because, that was a huge, huge piece of it. I think that we're not willing, we as a society are unwilling, seem unwilling, to sacrifice for a greater good. I think that there have been generations that haven't, the old adage of was hard, strong men create good times and good times create weak men. And then weak men create hard times. I think we're in one of the downward trending cycles of that right now. I think that folks that were born in the, call it in the late 30s through late 30s on, just have not, well, late 30s through like, call it like 1970, have just, they lived a blessed existence. They lived in a world that was created by the sacrifices of their parents and grandparents. And I don't think that those, I don't, like, they've never known real discomfort, right? Largely. Everything's been handed to them. World's gotten easier, I think many folks that have been born after 1970 have lived through a lot. But I don't think that many of us are prepared, really.
No, and I think, I think not enough people have traveled either. And I think that is a indicative of what you're talking about. I mean, we lived. So 5 out of 20 years, We lived abroad in beautiful countries, but we had an opportunity to see a lot of the world. And then on top of that, all the deployments to not beautiful countries to also see that part of the world. People don't necessarily realize how good we have it. And because they don't travel, or when they travel in a very curated experience. They don't get exposed to like what real poverty looks like. They don't get exposed to what real inequality looks like. They don't get exposed to what real hardship looks like. And so they assume that it's really hard.
Yeah,
because
man.
their personal experience is what they want it to be. They're not living that, that Instagram life or whatever. I think that if people traveled more, they would get some real exposure. But I mean, that's, there's all the reasons why not to do it. It's expensive. It's time consuming. But I think people just don't know. They're like, yeah, this America's messed up. It's like, man, if you say that, it just means you haven't been to some other places. You should go travel some.
But at the same time, we as a country absolutely are messed up in some ways. You know, like growing up in the DC area, I grew up in one of the wealthiest counties in the country. And for a couple of summers, I would go, this is in high school. I did a service trip where I'd go out to the Appalachia Valley, right out in West Virginia. And it was with a church program, and we like went into folks' homes and remodeled them essentially for them because they didn't have that, right? And I mean, this is, early 20-aughts, so like call it 2003, 2004, 2005. I mean, those are the first houses I'd ever been in that didn't have running water, didn't have electricity, didn't have, a septic system, had outhouses still. And I think that there are many places in the country that are like that, also you go into any inner city. I mean, like I have a business up in Baltimore County, right? My mental health company. I have an office up there. You go into Baltimore, right? Parts of Baltimore, parts of it are gorgeous. Parts of it are gorgeous, but then there are other parts where it's block by block, where one block's amazing and the next block is, let's just say, not amazing. And then there are areas where, it's just boarded up houses and it's not a great place to be. And those are absolutely problems in this country, right? And I think that there are always going to be people that don't do as well as folks like yourself and I have had the blessing to, right, Clint? But, I also think that that's a matter of, are you going out to seek it? Are you curious about the world around you? Are you interested in what's going on?
Yeah. And are you willing to, I mean, are you willing to suffer for what you're looking to achieve? I mean, what your goals are. And you're right. I mean, there are definitely parts of our country that are underdeveloped, that are overly reliant on kind of different levels of crime in order to kind of make ends meet. I mean, there's a number of things that are wrong, right? But I mean, it goes back to like, what's the old saying? Like, capitalism is a horrible form of governance, except it's the best one that we've ever had.
Yep.
I mean, it's kind of like, I wish that that I could point to some utopian society that, I mean, I've seen all the world. I've lived in Scandinavia. I've lived at all the places that people talk about. They're the happiest people in the world and all of that. And at the end of the day, they all have problems. At the end of the day, like, if you don't live there and see it, you don't understand what those problems are. And I would just say, just to come back to it, if in mass, we are the richest, most blessed country ever in the history of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's just, there, it doesn't mean we can't be better. I was just harassing my children about it last night. Like, hey, we can all be 10% better, like 100% of the time. And that should be everyone's goal, is to be better than you are. And we should be, right? But I mean, we're still so much better off than a lot of other places.
Oh yeah, man. And to your point, one of my favorite sayings, and it's real cheesy, but I love it, is it, the
I
biggest
love cheesy.
The biggest room in the world is the room for improvement.
I love it. I love it. I'm gonna use that, man. I'm gonna use that on my kids tonight, just to see what
Hell
happens.
Yeah. Hell yeah! You gotta let me know. Absolutely, man. Absolutely.
Oh, it's so good.
Yeah, but dude, so on a lighter note, man. Just for folks in general, what was the hardest? Like, what was the hardest part of going from a going from a Marine to a tech entrepreneur?
My pride, probably. No. I want to be in charge. No. You know, it is a, I mean, it is a massive hurdle transitioning out of the military. Like, it just is. I think that the tech space is an interesting space because it kind of, in some ways, it offers that kind of original American dream. Like, anybody can do it. Anybody can become president. Anybody can run a company, whatever, and become like multimillionaires and all the things, which I'm not. On one hand, they offer that, but on the other hand, there's all these barriers to entry that you don't necessarily know are even there. And so you run face first into it. Like, liquidity is a massive barrier to entry. So, like, how do you get, liquidity? So the learning curve was extremely steep. And I was very fortunate to have two founders that both have experience in startups and both have like and I've been successful in that space. And so, where I was wholly ignorant in a lot of this, they had exposure. We had a really insightful and talented group of advisors around us to help point us in the right direction and keep us kind of like keep the wheels on the train moving type deal. But I mean, it really is just, I mean, some of it is just like, hey, I'm gonna get comfortable being uncomfortable, and that's just how you have to live. Like, hey, this is gonna be weird, and every day is, I don't ever know what's gonna happen. I walk out, I wander into my office, and I'm like, oh, let's see. Some days are amazing, and some days are not. But every day is a challenge, and every day I go to bed mentally exhausted, and I consider both those things to be awesome. Like, I wouldn't do it any other way.
Yeah, man, I love it. I always like to tell aspiring entrepreneurs, there's gonna be good days and bad. The difference is, as an entrepreneur, the poles are exaggerated. The highs are higher, the lows are lower. And sitting and walking through that is, I mean, it just takes, I mean, it just takes a huge amount of resilience, right? And mental fortitude and mental toughness. And that the only way you build that, it's a muscle, right? The only way you build that is by picking the heavy thing up and putting it down over and over and over and over and over and over and over. And I've been doing this shit for 10 years now, man. So I know just what you're saying. It's wild. What advice would you give to, say, somebody listening right now? They're in the process of transitioning out. This could be either to just to, as as a veteran, what would you give advice would you give somebody, or as somebody going out that wants to start a company?
Don't self-limit. I mean, I think that's the biggest thing. I think too many of I saw, I witnessed too many people transition and do it with the idea of being comfortable. I'll go be a consultant somewhere or go just basically do what I've been doing in the military, but now do it for a bigger paycheck, in the commercial space or advising somebody trying to sell to the military. And I think I would challenge everybody that's transitioning right now, like, your service hasn't ended. We still need you. Like, get back in the fight. That fight doesn't, it's no longer about, BZO and putting down bad guys. It's about how do I get up and down every day to make this country better. Like, that sense of service should not have left anybody whenever they exited. And today I would say that we need that more in the tech space than anywhere else. And that's because we there is a cadre of people, military professionals leaving the service right now that have 20 years of warfare under their belt and have experiences and exposure to all the things that we've talked about and unique perspectives on all of it. Like, I don't pretend to be right about anything. We need them to get engaged in the next, phase of what America is going to be, which is a technological giant. And in order to do that, you got to take some risk. You got to accept that risk. You got to move into it. You got to try to limit your risk as best you can. Like, none of us should be taking blind risk. But we need you in the space. The tech industry needs you. We need leadership. We need understanding. We need domain expertise. We need context. I mean, that's what I would say.
It's amazing, man. I appreciate it. As we get ready to wrap up, man, is there anything else you'd like to say? Any other points you'd like to make, Clint? Anything I should have asked, but I didn't?
No, I mean, I think I want to, I mean, I will go back just because I pulled these, I have two quotes that I have in my office, and I pulled them down just because I want to stress them, because I as much as I don't want to do it in a Debbie Downer way, but like, as much as I want to like talk about technology and about what we're building and all those things, like, we cannot forget the fact that war is about lethality. And so, like the Marine Corps, amusingly enough, the Marine Corps, as much as they like to call us crowd eaters, we actually are fairly insightful people. And so, people much smarter than me. Just the two quotes. One of them is the mission of the Marine Rifle Squad, and this applies today as much as it ever did. And the mission of the Marine Rifle Squad is to locate, close with, and destroy the enemy by fire and maneuver, or to repel the enemy's assault by fire in close combat. Like that's what our system does. Like that's what it's intended to do. We're applying that on scale, and that does not change. And if we ever get to the point of thinking that we can technology ourselves out of like war, we have bought into fool's gold. And then the only other one that I think applies to all the stuff we talked about, and this is from war fighting, which is kind of the base, like the baseline doctrine for the Marine Corps. It describes war. It says war is a violent clash of interests between or among organized groups characterized by the use of military force. War is fundamentally a human endeavor. It's driven by the interplay of danger, physical exertion, uncertainty, and chance. It is shaped by human will. I think that those things are like those two things. They're in my office because they're so important to understand. Like th this is no matter what we are doing, it is on behalf of the warfighter. And it is with a very clear-eyed view of the fact that ultimately it is only lethality that gets us out of that next war.
Man, I appreciate it. I appreciate the quotes, Clint. Thank you so much for coming on Robots and Red Tape, man. It's been a great time. I really appreciate it, and I appreciate your perspective.
Dude, I really appreciate your time. This is always super insightful. I learn more than I ever give out, so I appreciate your time and you be willing to do this and talk to us as we as we navigate this force that we're in right now. But it's exciting, and I'm excited to watch what you guys have going on.
Absolutely, man. And everybody, thank you for listening to Robots and Red Tape. Hope you're all having a great day.